herzlich willkommen zu Atelier Talk, dem Podcast mit Gesprächen über Kunst und Kreativität mit allem drum und dran. Und mit mir, Stefanie Hüllmann, und normalerweise auch mit Nina Gebke. Aber heute haben wir wieder einen Interviewgast. Heute bin ich verbunden mit der Fotografin Christina Nyborg. Christina ist Norwegerin als Kind und auch später nochmal hat sie dann in Kalifornien gelebt. Beruflich war sie dann in New York City und jetzt lebt sie seit einigen Jahren schon in Kanada, von wo sie mir auch zugeschaltet ist. Christina ist Fotografin. Sie ist sehr erfolgreich gewesen als Fotojournalistin. Sie wurde von Zeitungen und Zeitschriften in viele Teile der Welt geschickt. Sie ist zusammengetroffen mit Präsident George Bush Jr. Sie hat in Oslo den Bombenanschlag dokumentiert und hat sehr erfolgreich in dieser Sparte gearbeitet. Dann aber sind so einige Dinge in ihrem Leben passiert, die von außen vielleicht erstmal gar nicht so dramatisch klingen für manche, die aber ihr ganzes Leben umgekrempelt haben. Und auf diese Art und Weise hat Christina, sagt sie, ihre eigene Identität ganz neu durchleuchten müssen und neu finden müssen. Und über diesen Weg der eigenen Identität, hat sie ihre Fotokunst nochmal ganz umgekrempelt. Und aus dem Fotojournalismus ist dann ja Kunst geworden. Ich finde das einen ganz spannenden Weg. Nina und ich sind der Meinung, dass das, was Christina uns zu erzählen hat, eigentlich fast jeden betrifft, der Kunst macht. Eben dieses Auseinandersetzen mit sich selbst, dieses bewusste Suchen und Erkennen von sich selbst. Ja, und Christina hat eine ganz besondere Art, das zu berichten, hat ihren eigenen Weg und den lässt sie uns oder an dem lässt sie uns teilhaben. Da Christina, wie gesagt, Norwegerin ist und sehr lange in Nordamerika gelebt hat und jetzt aus Kanada zugeschaltet ist, führen wir dieses Gespräch auch auf Englisch. Mein Norwegisch ist quasi nicht existent. Christinas Deutsch ist auch zu minimal. Von daher wünsche ich euch ganz, ganz viel Spaß mit diesem spannenden Gespräch mit Christina Nyborg und unserem ersten englischen Interview. Hello, Christina. So good to see you. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming to this interview. Christina, you are in Canada, in Ottawa right now, right?
That's correct, yeah. I'm in the capital of Canada.
But you come from Norway.
Yes, I come from the capital of Norway, Oslo. Just stick to the capitals.
In my preparations for this interview, of course, I checked your website and I looked at the internet a little bit. And I found something very, very interesting. And I would like to start with that.
Okay.
When I checked your website, I found about and I found the point Meet Christina. Mm-hmm. And there, the very, very first sentence, it says that you would like to acknowledge that the land on which you live is in fact the territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people.
Anishinaabe.
I just want to say that I definitely mispronounce this word. Algonquin Anishinaabe people, which means that these people were there way before anybody came to the country, and especially Europeans, I guess. And you also write that you express your gratefulness to that people, that you are allowed to live there. And now that's a very strong statement, I find. And especially on an about page, about yourself, when I go on your website and I look at about and meet Christina to find something like this as the very first sentence, that was really stunning to me. And because this is obviously very, very important to you, and because I am very curious, I would like to start our interview about the subject. Why this introduction? Why does your introduction about yourself start with this people?
Well, I'm an immigrant in Canada, which means that, like, technically I'm a settler because the people who lived here before any Europeans lived here, they were forced to give up their lands. They were forced to give up their children, which there's been a lot of news about recently. And all of this, I find all of this to be very, very different than from where I'm from. And also something that needs to be respected and spoken about and acknowledged. And I think that's probably one of the most important things, is the more we acknowledge that the past and our ancestors have done so much harm and caused so much trauma to an entire population of people. And the more we speak about it, the more we can also work to fix, and not fix it. There's no way to fix it, but work to find a way to live together as people who can share land. And there's a lot about how the European and the Western cultures move through spaces that can be pretty forceful and privileged. And we don't take enough time to pause and think about the world we actually live in, and how we live, and how we consume, and how we and what we're leaving behind for our children and their children. And I think that if we were to acknowledge more about our past, maybe we can learn how to manage the planet that we live on in a better way.
I understand all that, and I appreciate it so much, but still, and I understand that you, as a settler, as you said, you feel you want to acknowledge that. Let me pose the question differently. To find an acknowledgement like that somewhere on the website, maybe the beginning of your work, or maybe at the top of the page, but it's about Christina. And that's where you decided to put this acknowledgement. So that means it changes, or it does something with you personally, with you and your life, maybe your work, that you are exactly there where you are right now with that people whose name I can't pronounce. What exactly does it with you personally, with your life?
Okay. Well, so I grew up in Norway, and my grandmother, she's from Northern Norway, and she did not, in Norway, there's many different dialects, as I'm sure there are in Germany as well. So in the Northern Norwegian dialect is very different from the Oslo dialect, but my grandmother, she just died this year. She got it to be 100 years old. She's a very cool lady. She had turned her dialect into the Oslo dialect. So she had like managed to wean herself off speaking the way she grew up speaking. And when I got older and moved to her hometown in Northern Norway, I slowly started to discover that the ancestry that she had there was not one that she was very willing to talk about very often. So my grandmother is part Sami, which I don't know if you're familiar with Norwegian culture at all, but the Sami people live in the north. They're associated with reindeer herding.
In German, it's die Lappen.
Yeah, that is, we don't use that word anymore.
Yeah, in Germany it's used, yeah.
Mm. Oh, really? Okay, that's interesting, because that's considered derogatory now.
Okay, oh, yeah. Maybe I'm behind, maybe.
it's okay. Yeah, but it's the last like 10, 15 years it's come, like we've stopped using that word. But, and I think maybe they might still do in Sweden. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, but in Norway, we do not use that word anymore. And she would never talk about her mother or her grandmother being from an area that was predominantly Sami, because she didn't want to be Sami. So I wrote my entire thesis around and for my master's around the fact that I was starting to find some of my Sami roots, but my grandmother was refusing hers. And it's from her that I have them. And like in doing that work around identity and my own identity, when I moved here and I started becoming more aware of the atrocities that people have gone through in North America that are indigenous to the land and have very strong connections to the land, I felt both guilty because I'm a white person, but also really sad because I have felt that on my own person, that like there's this loss of culture that came with the Norwegianification of the Sami people. They were also taken from their parents and put into residential schools, or like they were also put into Norwegian schools, and like they wanted to make a Norwegian out of the Sami people. Like it was very bad. And the loss of that culture made her embarrassed because it was stigmatized, her background. So she would never admit to it. And I got her to sort of admit to it once, but it just felt very sad for me that she felt she needed to distance herself from this beautiful culture.
Yeah,
because Norway had decided that for her. Mm-hmm. And so when I moved here and I found that it's very similar here, it's like on a much grander scale and in a much more, I want to say serious matter, because there was a lot of really bad things that have been done to the Indigenous people of Canada. I felt like that is something that I need to honor, so that if somebody who is Indigenous in North America who come to my page and see me, I want them to know that I'm a person that will take them seriously no matter where they come from, because it's my work is made by me, but it's not about me. Like a lot of my work is about other people, and if I'm unwilling to, if I center myself too much in my work, which I do naturally, because a lot of my work is around identity and my own identity, but I don't want people to think that my work is about me, because I am trying to make work that speaks to other people about them. Mm-hmm. So that's partly why it's there.
Thank you.
Also have another page on there that's entirely devoted to that. So, yeah.
Thank you for answering that question
so
deeply. And I can understand that that it's in you, and that it also, of course, influences your view, your way of looking at things, especially since you are a photographer. We haven't talked about that at all yet.
Yeah.
You are a photographer and a teacher, an educator, yes. It says on the website. And when did you start your doing art? Were you always the creative child, or how did it start with you?
Yeah, I guess I was. I've always been, I don't really have any similarities to my brother or my family, but my mother was an art historian, or she is still an art historian. My aunt is an artist. And my dad is an economist. And my brother is an economist. And so it's just like, I always thought I would go into, you know, a more stable profession, because that's how I was raised. I was raised to get good grades and go to a good school and, you know, do the whole Western European thing. and then I went to school for lots of things. Like I went to school in California when I was 19. And you could choose in California. In Norway, when you go to university, you have to pick. You have to pick the thing that you're going to do, and that's what you're going to do, and you're doing that. But when you go to school in North America, you get to pick a direction, but you still have to do a lot of other classes of other things. So it was great for me because I got to do a lot of different things while I was first I was going to pursue psychology, and then I was going to pursue, I don't even know what I was going to pursue. There was lots of things. I was 19. I had like tons of interests.
Yeah. And where in California did you live?
Well, first I lived in a place called Davis, California, and I went to school in Sacramento, and then I moved to San Francisco.
Okay.
But, but I went to school, I tried journalism. I thought journalism seemed fun. So I got a spot on the like school paper and I started writing. So I was like, I like writing. I've always liked writing. Writing is fun. And so I started writing, and then I decided I need to go to school for journalism. So I moved to San Francisco and I went to school for journalism as a writer. And then I figured, well, if you're going to write, you also need to know how to photograph. Like, you have to be able to do everything yourself. I'm like very much like a one woman band always. I like to do all the things. I want to do all the things. And so I took a photography class and I was just really good at it. And I was very surprised because I've never been very good at art. I can't do that. Like sitting still for that long, focusing on like one thing, and then it like takes you forever and it's layers and it's just, it's too complicated for my brain. But pictures are instant. And I love stories and I love people and I love talking and I love talking with people. And all of those things are things that come with photography because you have to, and it's so uncomfortable sometimes. Like sometimes you're so out of your comfort zone trying to go and speak to strangers about their life and ask them if you can, you know, have a photograph of them. That's also kind of uncomfortable because it's in kind of like an invasion. But like that discomfort also brings a lot of interesting, like you learn so much from both journalism and photography because you have to ask questions, and being a naturally curious person, that was just, it was just a very perfect place for me to be. So
yeah, I think that's what I have to do from now on. Become a photography journalist. So, did you, when you talk about photography like that, and did you always have the approach to your photography that it is art as well? Or did you, what was your point of view?
Not in the beginning. So for the first, I would say, 15 years of my work, I considered myself solely a storyteller. Like that's all I ever did was make pictures to go with stories. And I worked for newspapers mostly and magazines. So a lot of my work was always editorial. So I'd always had to accompany text. Mm-hmm. And so I always photographed with that in mind. And it was kind of limiting. And it's less so now, I feel, either because I got older and I don't care as much about what they think on the other side of the editorial table, or it just has changed. Like photography has changed a lot in the 20 years that I've been doing this, but it just like became like a way for me to express myself through stories. And then after I had children and I didn't get to go out and photograph in the same way anymore, it changed. Like it became more, like I started seeing more like the storytelling aspect of photography can also be art, because art is so broad and you can make art just by living in it. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it that your motherhood changed your point of view, your way of looking at things? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, it did, but it's because it's like a transitional phase. I think every time you go through a transition in your identity, you're going to find new anchor points to point your things to. So for me, what happened when I became a mother was, first of all, it was like a complete shock. Like, it's just nuts. Parenting is nuts. And you know, you're kind of prepared for the lack of freedom because you've been kind of told, but there's like nothing anyone can ever do to explain the full on relentlessness that is motherhood. And so it was just a complete shock. But it really, like, I up until I became a mom, I had been going really fast. Like, my career was going really well. I mean, that wasn't fast. It didn't feel fast, but I guess it was fast. I went straight to work right out of college in New York. So it was, I had a very privileged, fun start to my career. And then that I got to build on that later. Mm-hmm. So I had a really good time and I had a kid and I was forced to stop, like complete stop, because we also moved to Canada. So everything, I knew nobody here. And in that full stop, oh, and then I had twins when my son was 15 months old. So I had three kids in a year and 3 months.
Oh, wow.
So there is just a complete stop.
That's like, there's a 180 degree change in your life. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, there's no freedom whatsoever. But in all that slowing down, I also started finding, like, okay, why am I in this field? What do I want to do with it? How can I use my camera now to, like, survive this complete mind fuck that motherhood is? Because it really is, excuse my language. And it just,
it's true. It's absolutely so true. Yeah.
But it became like the thing that I could hold on to that was still mine, that still belonged to my identity. And then also the thing where I was like, okay, my children are here and I can photograph them and practice and, like, have a practice around them. And then in that process, create something for them and for us of this, like, really special, but completely insane time. And so that's when I started realizing, because, you know, I look at my kids and to me, their art, like, everything they do is hilarious. Even when they're pissing me off, they're hilarious because they're just so small.
How old are they now?
My oldest is 8 and the twins are 7.
Oh, yeah. And you are working again as a photographer, but also teaching. Are you a freelancer and you can do your time the way you like to, or how did you get arrange everything now?
Well, in my job, and this has always been my job, I've learned to pivot a lot. So in the past 20 years, I've been doing this for 20 years, and there's never been a time where I've been like, oh, everything's easy now. Like, I can just rest. Like, I can buy a house in 5 years, or, you know, like, there's none of that. It's always a hustle. But I've also found that in order to keep certain parts of my enjoyment of this craft alive, I also have to do other things. And so there was like a 10-year period when I was only photographing for newspapers. But even when you photograph for newspapers, even though that's like a super fun place to be and it feels really great to accomplish that, you still have to go out and make really boring pictures a lot. You know, like, it's still a job that feels like a job often. And so when the motherhood thing happened and I had to quit that part of my practice, I started looking for ways I could keep working in photography while also keeping a flexible schedule so that I can pick up my children from school, be home with them when they're sick, because my husband works in the government and it's less flexible. Mm-hmm. So I teach workshops and then I...
From home,
from here. Mm-hmm. I started at the kitchen table in where we used to live, and it's sort of just progressed. And then I photograph families, other people's families, like in their everyday life. And I photograph children who, like, their school portraits. I do that in our garage. I just hang a backdrop and then they come and sit on a bench and I make some pictures. It's really fun. And then I have a body of work now that's going to be published in a book next year. So I'm making a book right now. Mm-hmm. That's another fun new experience. But it's, I think the point of this long spiel now, I guess, is that it's a multifaceted job. It's not just to go out and make pictures. And I haven't done any editorial assignments in a very long time. 2016 was the last time I was out doing that, because it hasn't, there's been no space for it.
On your website, I found that you have this habit that you take 1 month off per year. Yeah. And you do some kind of personal project. Do you still do that?
No, I haven't done that since the kids came.
And how did that start? How did you develop that practice?
Well, it was because, like, I was living in New York, and my job was to jump whenever a Norwegian newspaper, European newspaper called. So you're always on call. And this is before the smartphone. So I remember having to, like, walk around New York City with, like, my backpack and my laptop in it, so that I could sometimes go into Starbucks and check my email to make sure I wasn't getting any assignments that day. And, like, your phone's always on, because I worked for Europeans. So they would call me in the middle of the night, because they don't check time zone stuff. They're like at work, and they're like, I gotta call this person. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. So that was really tiring. Like, you know, it breaks you down. Like, it's fun, but New York, I don't know if you've ever been there, it's very overstimulating. Yeah. And so I found out that for my birthday every year, I'm born in March. So March is a good month to do stuff. And so March, I would spend going somewhere. So I would go somewhere I'd never been, and I'd stay there the whole month, and I wouldn't know what I was going to do, but I'd have, like, an idea, and then I'd create a personal project around it. So I went to Hawaii and Africa, South Africa, sorry.
But what was the, was it to get out of New York for a while, mm-hmm. or was it to get all that clutter out of your brain, or to develop new ideas? What was your main
all of those things?
Okay.
Yeah, because I realized that I was going in a pace that didn't work for my brain and my body, and in order for me to stay happy going at that pace, I also had to have a time in the year that was not that at all, so that it could be completely slowed down and completely just, like, zenned out. And I've never been very good at meditating or regular yoga practice or any of, like, these things have always been around, but it's not something that I'm very good at scheduling in to do all the time. But I have been pretty good at finding those, like, chunks of time where it's like, this is my time. And I will create a boundary around it so that nobody can disturb me in this time, so that I can clear my palate or my head and figure out what's my next step for the next thing. And am I still going in the direction that I want to go?
Is that something you've always done, to find your own place and your own time? And then those 1 month projects grew out of that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah,
because it's very unusual. I mean, I don't know anybody who says this month is for me, and I just creatively try whatever comes along. It sounds perfect. It sounds
yeah. It wasn't very financially smart.
Well, I can imagine it was, maybe not directly from the pictures you took, but from getting new ideas and developing views or thoughts or. Yeah, I'm sure that it was financially interesting. Who knows? You would have burned out, and then you would not have earned anything.
Yes, and burning out is always, it's been my number one fear in this job, because creatives do burn out quite often. I find that I burn out, like, in a cyclical way. So it's like every 3 to 5 years, I hit a wall where I'm like, oh. Okay, what am I doing?
Because, like, it was too much.
Yeah, it's just like, you don't know. Because, you know, you always have goals in a creative job. Like, you have to have them, or you have nothing to work towards. Mm-hmm. And if you don't hit those milestones, or maybe somebody hits a milestone before you that you've been traveling alongside, sometimes that hits you in the face. And even though you know that they're on their path and you're on your path, these are still things that, like, can affect how you work. And that can get very hard. Like that can get heavy. And that's when like I bring out my resume and I'm like, should I redo this now and like see if I can find a 9-to-5 job somewhere? But I've also like become old enough now to understand that my brain isn't wired in that way. And I have to also respect how I work and be the person that I am at my job. And it's worked for me for 20 years. So why would it not work for the next 20? Or, I mean, I'm probably going to be at this till I'm in the grave, but.
And do you also feel that as a creative, it's very hard to say no to projects that come along because they are daunting. They bring new things along. They might bring money. And then if you say no, you might miss out. And so you take everything on and you say yes, and you try to do this and that. Is that something you need to cope with sometimes?
I used to. Yeah. It's something I used to do when I was younger and not a mom. Yeah. But now I have these natural boundaries put in place that are my children. Like they are still not old enough to do things on their own. So I cannot do things at any given time, even if I want to. And so I think in a way, I'm so grateful to them for creating these boundaries for me that I wasn't able to make for myself. Mm-hmm. As a younger person, because it's opened my eyes to the fact that you have to have boundaries in your work and your personal life in order to function, or you will burn out. Yeah. And burning out is not a good place to be. I mean, I think we've all experienced a bit of burnout in the past 2 years because it's just been overwhelming much, everything. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to honor that by like slowing down and like zoning out, you know?
Yeah. Slowing down and zoning out brings us into the direction of boredom. You are someone who says that boredom is extremely important, maybe for everyone, but especially for creatives. Can you explain that a little deeper?
Yeah, well, it's not a scientific fact for me. I haven't read any peer-reviewed documents on it. But from what I have experienced in my work, if I don't allow my head to have a pause and to like reset, then I can't think of new things to do. And so like it's okay to keep going at like tasks and do all of the things. Like you run a business in a craft. You have to do all the admin stuff and all the taxes and all the emailing and marketing. And like we wear a million hats and we have to. So it can take away from like the fun parts. And if that's all we do, and then we run out and photograph because we've scheduled someone in for a session or we got an assignment or we have a project going, like there's no stillness in order to figure out what to do next. Like there's none of that like 1 month a year thing happening at all. And if that doesn't get brought into sort of your regular workflow and your regular practice, and it doesn't need to be like in a very sort of rigid way, like, oh, on Mondays from 8 to 10, I sit still and stare at the wall. You know, it's not like that. It's more like, I mean, because we've kind of destroyed boredom with smartphones. So if you're at the doctor's office, everybody sits on their phone. If you're on the bus, everybody sits on their phone. If you're waiting in line to get your vaccine, everybody's standing on their phone. Like everyone's on their phone all the time. And in those times where I'm doing mundane tasks, like doing the dishes or standing in line or waiting to pick up my children from school, I have made sure that that's like a cell phone free zone.
Go ahead.
Just so that I can allow my brain to have that reset and like process everything that's happened during the day or night and then come up with something, because it needs pause to do that.
So you actually do mean that uncomfortable feeling boredom and not slowing down, because that's two different things, right? You are convinced that really being bored for, and even if it's just a couple minutes, is something your body and your brain needs, correct? And it's different from just taking things easy and...
It's a part of it. So for me, this is like in two parts. So the boredom into your everyday, like getting rid of your phone every time you feel like you're not doing something, like the busyness that we have adopted by having this technology is very detrimental to both our mental health and to our brains coming up with new things, especially for creative people, because we are too busy looking at things for our brains to come up with its own things. You know how, like when we were kids and you're like, just like, I'm bored. And then your mom would be like, go find something to do, you know? And like, that's what we did, because we had no computers. And then we went outside and we like built a snow fort or sat and stared at leaves, you know, like these things do something for our brain. It's like resets our central nervous system so that we can breathe and remember how to breathe, and breath is important for that. And slowing down is the same thing. It also comes back to like the breath. You have to, if you're constantly rushing and you're constantly checking your emails and you're constantly in this kind of like jagged sense of having to accomplish and having to produce and having to do a lot of things, you are in a heightened central nervous system state. So you are always kind of in like a fight or flight mode. And if you don't come down from that, the stress response will not allow your brain to actually think of new things, because it's always trying to focus on staying active and staying in motion and staying away from whatever hypothetical trouble lurks behind not checking Facebook every 5 minutes. So it's, yeah. So it's both of those things for me are combined. So in my work, I try to only take on what I have time for. And I'm really weird about time. Maybe not weird, but I have a very scheduled life, because it started when I had twins and this toddler, and I realized I could not get through the day without like a very firm schedule, because I needed space for me in the middle of the day, which meant I had to teach my children how to nap at the same time. Oh. Which I did I didn't do very, like the twins did well, but the oldest, he didn't nap alongside them very often, but sometimes I get them to overlap by like half an hour, and I get like half an hour to myself. Bliss. Yes, very. And so this schedule has like then like bled into my work life, because I realized that the only way I could build the business again would be by knowing exactly what hours I had in the day to do it and how much time each task would take. And then like applying that to my work life, in the sense that I would do those tasks at the times that I had to do them, but also at the times that my brain would be able to do them. So if I had like an hour in the morning, I knew that this task needed to be done then, because that's when my brain was the freshest. And then, so I also learned how to understand my brain better in this process of task making.
And was this something new for you? Did you learn in this period to structure your days like that? Was that something? So she's nodding.
Yes, I'm nodding. So the silent nod.
So you also learned very much about yourself in that period of time, right?
Yeah. And I think like when you become a mom, you're really hit in the face with these like daily mirrors of yourself. Like they walk around and imitate everything you do. So every bad behavior you have, you will see in your children. Every good behavior you have, you'll see in your children. And it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, it's a constant like reminder of who you are. And in that, you also get to learn more about who you are in relation to them, because you no longer are an autonomous human being. You are a person who has dependents.
Yes.
And they depend on you for life. Yeah. You need to keep them alive often, because they will climb things. They have no prefrontal cortex, so they don't understand danger. So they just do stuff. And so it's just, yeah. So learning how time worked with them and how my brain needed time for certain things allowed me to sort of pace the build of my new business in a way that I could stay true to the things that I needed, like boredom and slowing down. And then, you know, by a certain time, they would go to school and there would be more time in the day for me to do these tasks and plan these things. And that was like, that's how everything got built. It was just like a very sort of layer by layer, eat one bite at a time kind of deal. So yeah, the kids did that.
I have two questions now. I'm just thinking, which one do I ask first? Let me first ask a personal question, please. It feels like you were in a difficult time. You had to struggle to get everything going and with the children. Your husband was out working for the government, very important.
He was doing his PhD when we had kids. He just started working for the government 2 years ago.
Okay. But it sounds as if you were pretty much left alone with the children. What was it like for you that the husband, the man, is doing his job and you, who was a successful photographer, had to stay home and take care of three kids? If it's too personal, please.
Oh, no, it's fine. I'm totally open about that. I've been very bitter about that often. He does get to hear it sometimes, but I'm also married to a feminist. So it's not like he didn't, you know, we both went into this with open eyes. When he accepted the offer of a PhD, I was already pregnant and we knew that that's what we were going to do. So I moved to Canada with one child and thinking, you know, I could do that, but I didn't take into account how expensive childcare is in Vancouver, because we lived in Vancouver then. And I just couldn't afford working. And like, I had to reestablish a new career in photojournalism. Every time you move in photojournalism, you have to sort of reestablish yourself. And then we got pregnant again when my child was 7 months old with twins. And it was just, you know, all bets were off. Like everything that I had pictured was going to happen after we became parents didn't happen in the way I pictured it at all, like not even close. And so a lot of the struggle for me was coming to terms with the grief it was to lose a career I'd built, spent so much time building, like every ounce of my being had gone into building this photojournalism career that I was so proud of. Like I was so proud of where I was. I was so proud that I had like regular clients and I was enjoying my work and I worked well with the writers and it was just very exciting. And then I was all of a sudden just home in a foreign place with no help, no family, just me and my kids. And my husband is a biologist, so he was often in the field. And yeah, so it wasn't really fun. But I also knew that he would make it up to me somehow. And so it's not like when the twins were 18 months old, I went to Alaska for 3 weeks to do a project there. So he's like, he's a good dad, but I do get still bitter at him. And I'm like, I did all this for you.
Yeah. I understand that. It doesn't mean that he's a bad dad, but it still means that you had to give up a lot.
Yeah.
And yeah. Wow. Another question comes up about boundaries, and that boundaries very often make you double creative, because within the boundaries you suddenly have. But I put that question on the side because you were nodding again.
I love boundaries. I can talk about boundaries forever.
Okay, let's talk about boundaries. Yeah, okay. Because those were natural boundaries that you suddenly found yourself in. And yeah, you appreciate boundaries.
I do, because if you give a human being too many choices, they become that cartoon with all the question marks over their head. You know, they're like, I don't know what to do. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. If you have too many options, it's overwhelming. And so the minute you limit your options, it becomes really hard, but then you have to think about it. So if you are given lots of options. You don't have to think about it. You just have to make a choice. And making a choice is not the same as creating. You know, it's just, it's like a different thing. And so I love working within boundaries. I think it's really fun. It really brings out like the creativity in you, within you. And you can like, by restricting yourself, whether it's like within a time frame or with a certain tool or with a color or
with,
you know,
three children on your hand all of a sudden,
or juggling three children, it just it creates like an environment where you really have to like find what's important, what is important, and how can I make this into something that's works for me. And like, so my husband's a scientist, and when my first child was born, he said, I don't want you to make him into one of your projects. And so we agreed that the children would never be identified on the internet. Mm-hmm. So I could make pictures of him as long as he was anonymous. Mm-hmm. And that was like hours after my son was born. This agreement came into place. And as we had more children and I worked less, I was like, I got to photograph something. Like, I can't just walk around here with like dirty diapers and puke all over me. And, you know, my shirt was often like inside out backwards from the day before, you know, just you're a hot mess. And so that was my boundary for photographing the kids, was that they could never be with their face. And from 8 years of that, a whole body of work has arrived. All of a sudden, I have this body of work of children who are faceless. And it's speaking about motherhood and like childhood and the two things combined. And that's my book. That's what's coming out next year. Oh. And so they did become my project. I've never reminded him that like he said that. So don't tell him.
we had Sabina Doppelhofer here in an interview, who has the account Little Toes Pictures, I think.
Oh, I love her work. Yeah.
And so yours grew out of necessity, more or less. Yeah. But what you say, I think, is true for any art whatsoever. I have the feeling that my own art really started to grow when I made my own boundaries. I didn't have the situation you had, but within my art, I found, I gave myself rules. You have to only use one or two materials. You only have to, and so on and so on. And that's when it started off. And what I find when you pick your own boundaries, you start to work in series. It's not sometimes this and that, but it makes series, and you learn a lot about the object you're working with, as much as about yourself. Mm-hmm. And that is something I would like to ask you about. You said earlier photography is it goes quick. You just have to push a button and then it's done. And some people say that about, for example, abstract art. You just slap a little bit of color onto canvas and then it's done. And on the other hand, you say you learn a lot about yourself through your work. Explain that to us, please.
Well, I think in the past 8 years, more so, but even before I had children, I went on one of my month-long trips to Alaska. So March 1 year, I went to photograph a dog sled race called the Iditarod, and a Norwegian sled dog musher. She was going to race it for the first time. And she was a young woman in a field, in a sport that was mainly men and often older men. So it was a very patriarchal field and it's a sport where men and women race together. So I found it really fascinating, and it's a really hard race. Like, they mush dogs across Alaska in the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. So I just found her fascinating. So I wanted to photograph her, and we became really good friends over the 3 weeks that I was photographing her on this race. And so I just stayed with her in Alaska. I basically just left New York. I was like, I'm done with New York. I'm moving into the Alaskan bush. I'm going to live in a cabin without water or electricity with this girl and her 16 dogs. And that, I can't even charge my camera. Like, so I was like, oh, I'll photograph it with my Leica, no problem. And my Leica froze to death. It was just this like chaotic time. But that's when I was like, okay, this is who I am. I like being outside. I like that I appreciate the outside. I like winter. I don't like big cities and lots of noise. And I lived in New York City in like Chinatown, so noisy. And so like, I was starting to really understand that photography was showing me kind of who I was. And I had already done that in the past month long trips that I had done, but like that trip was really the manifestation of like, okay, I am in the wrong place. I do not belong in New York City. And so I left New York, and that year in Alaska was mind opening. And so I went back to Norway, but I moved to Northern Norway into the Arctic, and I started a master's degree there. And that master's degree took me back to Alaska. So I did another project in Alaska that summer. And that's kind of when I really started to come to terms with like how my family's identity and my identity and like how many things that like things that you're not consciously aware of, perhaps, but there are like parts of your history that lives in you, right? Like it's brought in through somehow, this love of outdoors, this love of preserving nature. And so when I was in Alaska on my master's degree fieldwork, I met this biologist from Canada who is an environmentalist. And so like that kind of led to where I am now. But it just like photography has always been sort of the compass.
Catalysator. Compass, yeah. Anchor point, you said in our talk before.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I understand. So it's not really the act of photography, of photographing, of seeing things or people, but it's, yeah, it's the compass. Yeah, that's probably great work. Which takes you places. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's also in the depth that you start like using it. So I'm curious. I'm really, really curious. And so when I point my camera at something, if I'm again curious, then I'm like, okay, why am I curious? And then I'll keep digging there. Yeah, and then once I like, that's when things come, like it gets revealed to me that this is something that I'm genuinely interested in. Why am I genuinely interested in this? And then it allows me to reflect on that. And all the things that I photograph have some personal connection to me. And in photojournalism before, that was not really considered a way to work. Like people didn't like that very much. They didn't like that you inserted your own person and interests into your work, because like they wanted you to be interested in the topics you covered, but they wanted you to go places that were exotic, you know, like it's always this drive to go and see other places or go photograph war or, you know, do these very like in-depth historical, big monumental things. And then for me, photography was always the happiest when I got to just photograph people doing very mundane, everyday sort of things. Like I'm really naturally interested in people's everyday lives. I find boring super fun.
but like, that is the step from journalist photography to art, I think.
Yes, I think
when you
so.
Bring yourself in and when you bring your interests in, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that makes sense that the newspapers probably were not interested in art because they felt it. Yeah.
Yeah, they are now more though.
Yes.
Interesting. They've changed, they're shifting.
Yeah. Oh, more art in the world, maybe.
Yes.
I have two more questions.
Go ahead.
You said on your website, or I read an interview with you somewhere, you said that every once in a while you're hitting a slump. And I wonder, that's not what we talked about earlier. I understand it's a slump. A creative slump that you just don't know what to do, where to go from now. And but you also said in that interview that you now have built a whole system around slumps so that you know how to tackle them, how to get out of them. Can you tell us about your system a little bit? Maybe everybody, every artist hits a slump every once in a while. How do
slumps
we get out
of
it?
Good too.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the first step is always to know your own brain. So in the past, like I'm 43 years old. So since my brain was fully developed at 25, I have spent a lot of time trying to figure out how it works and figuring out like how my brain works with how I work has been like a dance. You know, it's trying to like understand how I react to things and how like it's a self-reflection game. But in that, I've also started to understand the warning signs that my brain is going to give me before I hit one of these slumps, because it's been a few now. You know,
for example,
I started.
Which warning signs do you have?
Okay. So if I don't pick up my camera for a really long time, then I can see that in my Lightroom catalog now, because it has little numbers next to the months, you know, I'm like, okay. Before I would start freaking out. I'd be like, I'm not working enough. I'm not doing enough. I'm not producing enough. I'm not enough.
Yeah. Oh,
and wow. Now it's more about, okay, I needed a break. That's okay. It's okay to have a break. I had a break, and then I can figure out when I'm ready to not have a break. And then, you know, I could buy some plants or something in the meantime, or find a hobby or do some knitting, or, you know, there are other things I can do. So I don't freak out around the slumps anymore, where I used to really freak out because it felt like I wasn't making enough money. And the thing is, I grew up around economists. I grew up in an area of Oslo that's like full of people who appreciate money. And I never really felt home there. And it's not that I don't appreciate money. I really do appreciate the stability money can bring I'm really appreciative of my government or my husband's government job because it's steady. But it's also like, I've also learned to accept that I'm not going to ever have money. And so I think in that acceptance, the slump also kind of, like, I have to remind myself of that when I get into this hyper state where I'm like, okay, I'm not making. Mm-hmm. Like, why am I not making right now? Then I'm like, okay, I have to reconsider what is it that I want to make? What am I doing right now that I am making that I'm not seeing? Like, often it's just the back end of the business. I'm doing administrative work, and that's also part of my creative job. And sometimes it's like, okay, I haven't had a break for my kids for 2 years because we've been in a pandemic. Like, it's okay to like feel shitty about that because mm-hmm. there's like, you're on all the time. There's no room for this like cleansing of the palate or yeah. And so I think more than anything, like the system that I have in place is just basically learning to accept that there are things that are out of my control and I will get back on track eventually because I always do. It's been 20 years. I've done this for 20 years. It's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And even if it's slow for a couple of years, it will still come back if I want it to. If that is something I want, it will happen. And not everybody becomes successful at 25 or 35 or even 45. Some people don't even break through until they're in their 50s or 60s. And that's okay because they probably had more fun building that foundation on the way.
Hopefully,
than people who burnt out at 40.
Yeah, hopefully they have more fun or they have lots of fun. Hopefully they don't stress themselves. Yeah. So the slump is very much about getting to understand yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you are a teacher, do you focus on both sides? Do you have photography classes as well as those things we talk about here, how to cope with a slump, how to get to know yourself, how to, and so on?
Yes.
Do you teach both? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I teach photography, but for me, when I teach photography, especially when I have live workshops, it's important that I meet my students where they are. And every student will come from a different place and every student will have different training in their background of how they got to where they are and different things that they want to do with their photography. But there's one thing that I always make sure that everybody who enters my workshop space understands, and that's that I don't care about perfect pictures. I just don't care. Like, they don't have to be perfect. I don't care about how many poles are sticking out of heads or chopped limbs or, you know, then these are things I'll mention to my students in critiques if I see it consistently coming up. But I believe that if you're going to become good at photography, all of those things will naturally fall into place over time, because you have to get certain images out of your system before you kind of graduate into the more like in-depth stuff. And if you're always staying true to the joy that is making photography and art, if you're always staying true to your curiosity and your hunger for like figuring things out, then those things will show up in time and when it's your time.
But that's true for any kind of art. If you, yeah, if you are a cook, you have to do all those shitty meals first and yes, taste it and find, okay, it's not, and then you can develop your own style. And it's the same for the abstract art I talked about earlier. Yeah. Interesting.
It's a practice. I mean, and that's why it's called a practice. It's an actual practice. It's a craft. Yeah. So no woodworker or plumber know how to do their jobs until they've been trained. And that's why they don't get certified until they've had a certain number of hours in their field.
Yes.
Oh, and it's the same for us.
That's so true for any art. Oh, you speak. That's sometimes when people, they've been drawing for a month and they say, oh, I can't do it. And they drop it. Nobody would ever go to a piano, try it for a day or two, and then say, oh, I still can't play this yes, darn, I can't do it. Yeah, so exactly the same thing. Thank you. Christina, one last question before we wrap up. You talked about that being a photographer, which is true for any artist, is very often, unless you're way up there, doesn't bring financial stability. But it says on your website, I read that you do have a couple of tips from all the experiences you have to anybody who would like to try it. Give us a couple of tips now.
Okay. Yeah. the first thing is to understand where you can apply your art. Like, what do people need, and how can you provide that? Because you have a service that you can give. And if you're just going to buckle down and say, no, I can't do that, that's beneath me, then you can't survive. It's like you have to know that, like, sometimes you have to do work that is not so fun so that you can fund the work that is fun. Mm-hmm. But those things go hand in hand, and everybody who has a job have moments of like super fun and super not fun. Like, it's just life. So that's one thing. And the other thing is learning how to communicate about your art, like how to talk about it is really important, because you can apply for grants. There's so many grants, and Germany has tons of grants. Like, Germany is funding a lot of art. There's like so many grants and contests and ways to like promote your work. So finding those spaces that do that, and the language, and learning that language that you need to communicate your work in, you know, two sentences or 500 words, that's very important. But also like finding avenues of like, what do you like to do? Like, if you don't mind having, you know, being waiting tables 3 evenings a week so that you can spend the rest of the week doing your art, that's great. And there's no shame in that. And that's the thing, like, we don't have to be just like, I don't think of myself as just a photographer, because I know that 10% of my time is spent on photography and 90% of my time is spent on funding my photography. And like, funding my photography right now, I do it through running workshops. I photograph kids in my garage. I photograph families. I do family portraits for their holiday cards. And it's not my favorite thing to do, but I do enjoy the kids. And so it's like finding ways to earn is important. We have to make a living, and it doesn't have to be a great living. It just has to be enough so that you can keep working at the thing that you love to do, because that is like meaningful and important. So yeah, those are my only tips, is to not be too picky about what you do around your art, so that
Thank
you can
you,
keep
Christina.
Making it.
Yeah, that's very valuable. Christina, I have asked quite a few questions. Is there anything you would like to say that I haven't asked?
I don't know. I don't remember what all the words that came out of my mouth. There were so many. But I'm always open for people. If they want to ask me any questions, I always reply to emails. So anyone.
So let us know where we find you, please.
You can find me through my website, which is www.christineniborg.com. I say it's Christina, but my name is spelled with an E, so I'll spell it www.christineniborg.com. And all of my info is there.
We put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yes. And Christina has a wonderful Instagram account. What's your handle there?
It's Christina _ Nyborg. Yeah, so it's just my name with an underscore in the middle.
We will put that into the show notes, and quite a few pictures of all the things Christina talked about, and even a couple more.
Yes.
Christina, thank you so much. This was a wonderful conversation. I could have gone on for another 2 hours.
Me too. I can talk forever.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. Thanks for asking me to come.
Das war ein wirklich sehr, sehr offenes Gespräch, finde ich. Christina hat uns sehr tief in ihre Seele und ihre Erfahrungen blicken lassen, sich dadurch auch verletzlich gemacht und uns dadurch aber auch, finde ich, reflektieren lassen, was uns und unsere Kunst ausmacht. Denn ob es nun Fotografie ist oder Malerei oder Kochen oder Tanz, ich glaube, dass sehr, sehr viel von dem, was sie uns erzählt hat, ja allgemeingültig ist in gewisser Weise, aber natürlich auch sehr speziell für Christina. Ich hoffe, es hat euch so gut gefallen wie uns beiden. Das Gespräch hat uns sehr viel Spaß gemacht. Die Shownotes stehen auf www.atelier-talk.com und die Fotos natürlich auch. Und andere Fotos seht ihr auf unserem Instagram-Kanal die ganze Woche über. Und der heißt Atelier Talk in 1 durch. Ja, damit lassen wir euch ziehen. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr das nächste Mal auch wieder dabei seid. Wir hoffen, es hat euch gefallen. Lasst es euch gut gehen und bis bald. Tschüss.